Welcome to the Summer of Peace, a free global online event designed to help you find inner peace and to take inspired action. The Summer of Peace is a production of the Shift Network, and this Global Compassion Summit is co-produced with Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, as well as the Charter for Compassion. The Global Compassion Summit highlights the latest science and practices that help us embrace compassion and recognize compassionate action as an important path to peace. We're so grateful that you're here. Please share your questions or insights at www.facebook.com/shiftnetwork. And now, your host for this call, Emily Hine, the director of the Global Compassion Summit.
Welcome to the Global Compassion Summit, a production of the Shift Network. This is Emily Hine, and we're so glad you're joining us today. I'm honored to introduce our guest speaker, Roshi Joan Halifax, a Buddhist teacher, Zen priest, anthropologist, and really a pioneer in the field of end-of-life care. She received her PhD in medical anthropology, and she's the founder, abbot, and head teacher of Upaya Institute and Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Roshi Joan is the founder of the Upaya Prison Project that develops programs on meditation for prisoners. She's on the Global Compassion Summit for the Charter for Compassion, and she's a fellow and board member of Mind and Life. There's really so much to appreciate about Roshi Joan Halifax, but what strikes me personally is her commitment to bringing compassion into one of our most difficult topics for us human beings, the topic of death and dying. Roshi Joan has lectured on the subject of death and dying at many academic institutions and medical centers all over the world. She's written beautiful, compassionate books on the topic. Roshi Joan dares to go where few people dare to go, and that is to the heart of suffering. We're very grateful you're here with us today. Welcome, Roshi Joan Halifax.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm excited for our session today. We're exploring the cultivation of compassion. So I thought we would start out slow and build up our compassion vocabulary and then work our way into some compassionate practices and real-life application. How does that sound to you?
That's great.
Okay. So let's start out with your definition of compassion and perhaps talk about how it differs from empathy.
Well, first I want to say that compassion is actually composed of non-compassion elements. And it is really important to train people in these various elements because they form a complex dynamical system that primes compassion as well as wisdom. And those elements include our capacity to attend, that is attention, prosocial affect, that is kindness and concern, ethical intention, our capacity for insight, and the other two elements that are really critical are embodiment and engagement. And so, you know, my own work in this field has been in the natural course of working in the end-of-life care field and training clinicians now since 1970, so that's 45 years. And seeing that often the conventional approaches to training and compassion were more behavioral and had less to do with cultivating the capacities internally that prime compassion. And so I developed a map of compassion, which is a heuristic map that's nonlinear and is context sensitive, and it is also a map that allows us to more easily train people in compassion. You know, my own work is drawn from the end-of-life care field, as you know, and these decades of training clinicians and caregivers. But it's also related to my own meditation practice and as well studying Eastern perspectives on compassion. But one of the most important has come from areas in my own experience from the increase of research in the area of neuroscience and social psychology. So you ask, what is compassion? And I see compassion as basically the having the capacity to actually attend to the experience of others and to feel concern for others and then to sense what will serve others and then potentially to be of benefit to others. And you asked me if there was a distinction between compassion and empathy, and there is a very clear distinction from my perspective and the perspective of a number of people in the field. In fact, there's been a kind of confusion about what compassion is and what empathy is, and a conflation between compassion and empathy that has not been necessarily useful. As I said, compassion is this capacity to attend, and it's the feelings of concern for others, and then to the ability to really sense into what will serve others, and then the kind of vow or the desire to be of service, even though sometimes we can't be of service, we can't directly benefit. Empathy, on the other hand, is that experience of emotional resonance, affective resonance, or emotional attunement, or affective attunement, where we sense into and actually resonate with or feel the experience of others. And there are two aspects of empathy that are defined in the world of social psychology. One is emotional attunement, but the other is cognitive attunement or perspective taking. But what's interesting about empathy, as we're beginning to see, is that if empathy isn't regulated either spontaneously or from a top-down perspective, people can experience a lot of personal distress. And so that's something that I think is really important for us to note at this time, that empathy is often a feature of compassion, but it's not all of what compassion is, and that empathy can also cause personal distress and behaviors and responses out of personal distress that are really difficult.
I'd like to tease that out just a little bit more. So empathy is a feature of compassion, and what I'm hearing you say is that when people stay in empathy versus perhaps moving into the desire to be of service, that's when there can be the empathetic distress. Is that correct?
Well, that's one way of saying it. It's more that when we, for example, if I'm with a person who's suffering intractable pain and I really am able to, you know, be sensitive to and sense into their experience, I can experience secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, simply by resonating with their experience. So the regulation of empathy is really important in being able to sustain oneself in the presence of a lot of suffering. And the work of Nancy Eisenberg and Daniel Batson is very interesting in this regard. I don't know if you have heard much about, you know, from your colleagues, much about this work, but it is, for me, a very important element for, or frame of reference for us to look at. Both are, Batson and Eisenberg are people who have done a lot of research on emotion regulation and on how empathy and compassion are, or sympathy, as Eisenberg talks about it, how we mobilize it. So what Nancy Eisenberg, who's done a lot of research on kids, and we took her research, my team, and we reframed it in relation to clinicians, that there are three streams that combine in a person's experience of presencing suffering that allow us to feel compassion. And they are empathy or emotional attunement, perspective taking, which I mentioned just a few minutes ago, or cognitive attunement, and memory, our personal experience. And these three streams that Batson Nancy Eisenberg, the social psychologist, has identified, combine within our heart and mind and body to arouse us sufficiently to, you know, feel something and want to do something. However, if that arousal level is not regulated, then the individual goes into the experience of dysregulation and personal distress. And Eisenberg talks about two ways of expressing or experiencing personal distress. And one of them is selfish prosocial behavior. That is, you know, we're involved in, you know, activities or behaviors that alleviate the suffering of others. But we're really doing it to relieve our own distress. Mm-hmm. And then the other is a pathway that leads to the three fear responses. And this is work that I've been deeply involved in, looking at the kind of edge states that people go through. And those responses include things like moral outrage, moral distress and moral outrage, which relates to the fear-based behavior of fight, and mm-hmm. avoidance behaviors where, you know, patients are avoided or abandoned. And this is related to the fear-based behavior of flight. And then numbing or freeze, that is being just completely shut down, frozen inside. And many people know this state, you know, all too well. So those are two ways that we experience personal distress. But when the arousal level is regulated, either because our system does it as in a normal way, this is how we're conditioned, or we're able to self-regulate by you know, returning to our breath or grounding, then our concern for others awakens, and out of this this pro-social behavior that's based in selflessness arises, and that's compassion. So you know, we see that empathy is a feature here, but it's not everything, and it can be a source of distress.
That makes sense, and I appreciate that you brought up the two ways that we can experience distress. I can identify times when I myself haven't been able to regulate, and I've taken one of the less preferred methods of avoidance or abandoning someone who really needed me. And so what I think might be helpful for listeners, I'm imagining that others can relate to that, is how to then cultivate that selfless pro-social behavior. You gave a couple examples of self-regulation, but I'm wondering if you could tease those out just a little bit further for the benefit of the listeners.
You know, what I began to see, as I've said earlier, is that compassion is made of non-compassion elements, and it's literally to cultivate balanced attention, to cultivate prosocial affect, to really work on the cultivation of moral sensitivity, so that our intention is pretty pure, to open up the insight process, to really cultivate wisdom, and to be more embodied. And I can say more about these features. Just cultivating compassion in a certain way as a whole system, without having attentional balance, for example, is not very easy. I mean, the mm-hmm. questions that I asked myself when I was working on this heuristic model of compassion was, can there be compassion without attentional and affective balance? And can there be compassion without altruistic intention and insight? And can there be compassion without embodiment and indirect or direct engagement? And my conclusion was pretty simple, is that no, we need to have attentional balance. We need to have emotional balance or affective balance, that our intention needs to be altruistic and not selfish, and that we need to have insight about how our own mental processes operate, and that, you know, really all beings want to be happy, and that embodiment was really important. So I can say more about that if you want, because I think it's pretty interesting in terms of, you know, how do we open up this sensibility within ourselves? And, you know, to jump to the kind of essence, as I said, I after, you know, 40 years of working in the end-of-life care field and seeing so much suffering, not only, you know, in the experience of patients and family members, but also clinicians, doctors, nurses, also volunteers, people who were really not able to regulate themselves and were suffering from pathological altruism and burnout and secondary trauma and moral distress and so forth. You know, I really wanted to find a way to help people more immediately cultivate compassion. And so I developed from this heuristic map, which is based on a Buddhist perspective, but also on current social psychology and neuroscience, a protocol, a process called GRACE. And it's a kind of back pocket process. It's something people can do. And this is not just for clinicians. It's as well for educators, it's for people who are in the field of humanitarian aid and so forth. And that, the GRACE process is really very streamlined, it's very inclusive, and it's really easy to learn on the simple level, and it's very, very deep in terms of the elements. And I'm wondering if you want me to share that with you right now.
Oh, I would absolutely love that, and I'm sure our listeners would as well. Please, thank you.
So just imagine that you're sitting across from somebody who's really having a hard time, and that you want to be present for them, and you also want to come alongside them. And the first thing that you do in this GRACE model, it's a mnemonic, and it is to gather your attention. It's to get grounded. It's to invite yourself to be balanced. So G in GRACE refers to gathering attention. And you can do this on the in-breath, just for a moment, take an inhale and gather your attention. The R of GRACE refers to our motivation. It is specifically recalling intention, where the G is gathering attention, G for GRACE. The R of GRACE is recalling intention. Understanding that our motivation for helping others is based on fundamental altruism, our concern and care for the world, of having a really developed moral ground. So the R of GRACE is just, it's a pulse, but it's understanding that our intention, which is selfless, is a tremendous resource for us. The A of GRACE, so we have G, R, and A, is attuning to self, and then attuning to other. So mostly what caregivers do in this endeavor to be compassion or actualize compassion is they're interacting with others. They're immediately allocating their attention to the other, not understanding that sensing into their own somatic, affective, and cognitive experience. They learn a lot about their biases, but they're also grounding and resourcing in this process. So attuning at the somatic level really allows us to be grounded, but also there's so much information coming from our body. And we can feel the tightness in the throat or the heart or the gut or the nervous systems pulsing or the heartbeat increasing and so forth. At the affective level, to see what emotions are present, and cognitive, what views are manifesting. And that gives us capacity for sensing into our own internal experience, particularly at the somatic level, where we're attuning to our visceral processes, actually primes the same networks associated with our capacity to sense into the experience of others. And after our self-attunement, which actually just takes a minor mind moment, then it's our opening our own capacity to sense into the experience of others in terms of somatic resonance. You know, our body really beginning to feel into, you know, what is this person's physical experience right now? And feel into their affective experience and sense into or do perspective taking what their cognitive experience is, which, as I said, is called perspective taking. And that's where affective and cognitive attunement are engaged, but there's also somatic attunement as well. And from this base, the sea of grace, which refers to the cognitive domain and our ability to consider deeply what will serve based in insight or discernment. And that's just a wonderful process, because it's not as if we exclude everything that we've learned from our education, our clinical training. We include that, but we also include the intuitive aspect or our sense of things and looking at things systemically, understanding that the patient or the child, if you're an educator, is within a whole system and what is really going to serve here. And then the E of grace is engaging. How can we engage in a way that has an ethical base and that really cultivates eudaimonia or flourishing? So this ethical enactment in our engagement with the individuals when we engage in compassionate action. And then there's a final piece to the E, and that's ending, which is how do we acknowledge within ourselves or interpersonally what has transpired. So this is a very, as you can see, simple model, grace, gathering attention, recalling intention, attuning first to self and then attuning to the other, considering what will really serve, engaging, and ending. And what I've been doing since I developed this process, I've been teaching literally all over the world in medical settings and other settings how to use this process in terms of our direct experience with people who are encountering a lot of challenges, whether it's in a schoolroom or in a medical setting. And it's been translated into Nepali and is now being used as a protocol for people who are working in direct aid in Nepal related to the earthquake.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful to see what's happening. People want and really need a kind of way to not experience compassion from the outside in, but from the inside out. And this is a wonderful way in order to do that.
It's such a beautiful process, Roshi Joan, and I appreciate the acronym so much, because it helps us remember that it isn't just one thing that we're doing when we're considering compassion and compassionate action. That it's literally like this, almost like a five-legged stool, and you have to cultivate all of those legs at an even level in order for it to sit upright and straight and be of service. And I appreciate so much this process. I'm wondering, because it does require so much in the realm of, you know, gathering attention, considering intention, attuning to yourself somatically so that then you can also sense into the other. And then there's a cognitive part of this and engaging with others. Does this require, this grace process require that you have a certain amount of training in mindfulness, for example?
Well, anyone who's had a lot of Buddhist practice knows that each one of these elements is a kind of big world of training unto themselves.
Right.
And it's a very deep and inclusive method. But what has been fascinating for me is how quickly people get it, and even what we could call grace light, you know, a kind of simple approach to grace, you know, where people aren't well trained, but where you just say, you know, on your in-breath, gather your attention. On the exhale, drop into the body. And then remember really why you're here. I mean, you know, you can do this in a very simple and accessible way. And also, it's true, just to be able to have attentional balance is a big assignment. So you and I both understand this, and I'm sure many of our listeners do. But it's something that is for general use, quick and easy to learn. As an immediate process, it's an incredibly streamlined, convenient, and inclusive method.
And so one does not have to be Buddhist or have a long mindfulness practice in order to begin to have grace.
Precisely.
Wonderful.
You feel what I mean?
I do, yeah. It's a lot, and I imagine, you know, that there are many people who are listening who have been in the throes of dealing with grief, the loss of a loved one, or perhaps they're a caregiver. And so this process seems like a fantastic way for people to kind of step out a little bit and exercise a more kind of holistic approach to being in that space. Are you finding that people are able to experience less empathetic distress when they use this process then?
You know, what has been really interesting for my team and for me has been how many people have been magnetized by it. For example, we just did a big training with 70 clinicians, and a number of clinicians said, "Oh, I can use this at home."
Mm-hmm.
If you know what I'm saying. And then another clinician said, this is really about healing. And then, you know, I made it clear that actually this is the essentials. The bones of compassion are in this method. And that when compassion is actualized, it has really powerful healing qualities. And this is, you know, kind of a fascinating situation, what's happening in the research on compassion today, because what we're seeing is how many, for example, Paul Ekman, you know, made a wonderful point that Darwin, toward the end of his life, felt that, you know, human survival is insured because of compassion, and he referenced something we would call survival of the kindest.
Mm.
And then Tanya Singer talks about compassion priming well-being and resilience because it triggers brain reward and pleasure networks. And then I know Zaki talks about how compassion actually registers in the brain. It's more like eating chocolate than Brussels sprouts. And then I love the work of Elizabeth Dunn, where in her research, she has discovered that helping others makes us really happy. And, you know, I have to say, in working, interacting with all of these many young people who are in Nepal, who have really exceeded, anything that the government is doing in bringing direct aid to these remote villages. And I keep getting messages from, Prem and Torah and Pasang and Dawa and Rinjan and, this whole group of remarkable, what I call the new leadership of Nepal. I'm talking about what joy they're experiencing in helping others. And Elizabeth Dunn says, she did a study on the experimental group spent money on others, and the control group spent money on themselves, and the people who, gave money, spent money on others, experienced much greater well-being than the control group. And then there are other things like how health-promoting compassion is, the work of Riff in looking at how compassion is actually lowering inflammation and how it strengthens immune response and it helps with recovery from illness. And I love Sarah Conrath's research. She talks about how it can actually enhance longevity and because it protects against stress. And she did an interesting piece of research where she saw that volunteers who were involved in volunteering, and their reasons for volunteering were altruistic, they lived longer than their non-volunteering peers. So we could see that people who are self-serving probably don't live as long as those who are about serving others. And then Cameron talks about how compassion affirms our moral principles, and that when we restrain our compassion, our sense of moral identity is compromised. And I love the work of Jonathan Haidt, where his work talks about compassion elevating you and others, and that seeing someone help another really creates a state of elevation that in fact inspires one to engage in the world compassionately. And then Fowler talks about it in terms of helping being contagious, and certainly we've seen this in Nepal in the beginning after the earthquake. Right in the beginning, I think people were in a state of shock, but Facebook has become this phenomenal platform for sharing altruistic endeavors, where Nepalis who, so many of them have, particularly the young Nepalis, but not just the young, they have mobile devices. And as a result of that, they've been, magnetizing each other to work, inspiring each other to work, to move food, rice, lentil, oil, salt, by the ton into villages, hiring trucks and helicopters, and now moving tin roofs and doing all kinds of reconstruction work. So, acts of kindness really beget more in a chain reaction of goodness. So it's, and there's more, in terms of social psychology and neuroscience in this regard about how compassion really engenders flourishing. So I think it's very exciting that the Charter for Compassion, what C-Care is doing, what we do here at UPAYA, the work of Tanya Singer, of course, Mathieu Ricard, what is happening is a kind of breakthrough in, the first kind of foundational work in the area of mindfulness that was primed by John Kabat-Zinn, and then Saki Santarelli, and all of those people out there teaching MBSR and bringing this into a global movement. Now with the work of Karen Armstrong, Richie Davidson, Mathieu, Ricard, Tanya Singer, myself, in moving compassion as an actualization of, if you would, mindfulness in action to benefit others.
Well, you certainly have been at the forefront of this movement, as have many of the people that you've mentioned. And I'm curious, you mentioned Karen Armstrong and her visionary leadership with the Charter for Compassion, and I know you're involved in that. As we look at this whole landscape, of compassion and what's happening, what do you think are the most important things that people can do to put compassion in action in their daily life? You know, it might be, you know, it might have different ramifications for different people wherever they are. But if people wanted to get involved in this movement and really instigate compassion in their own communities, what's your advice for those who are getting on board this compassion movement?
Yeah, I think we have so many extraordinary opportunities, to be perfectly frank. I just want to say that, you know, at the very beginning, my basic feeling is that it is really important to open up our own capacities, to nourish our own ability to actualize compassion, which, as I said, training in attention, training in prosociality, work on the development of our moral ground and moral character, and you know, this whole range of elements that I've been talking about. Another is to really reframe compassion, because compassion has been not well understood, and so the content that I'm talking about, you know, have been talking about in the past couple of minutes, is really important for us to understand that these elements really have to do with nurturing our basic goodness and our basic humanity. And also to understand that compassion is not a deficit. I think it's been misperceived, poorly framed in our culture. I love what His Holiness the Dalai Lama said. He said, compassion's not religious business. It's human business. It's not a luxury. It's essential for our own peace and mental stability. And it's essential for human survival. And I would suggest essential for human survival of the planet, or for the survival of the planet. So, and, you know, he also said it's the radicalism of our time. So there's many things that I think are important. But first is to disrupt our complacency and to engage our compassion and to spread the news that compassion's a sane, healthy, collaborative, radical necessity. And then there are so many ways for us to actually engage and to act. For example, to educate and protect the lives of children, our own and children in, you know, all over the world, and to sit with the dying and to feed the homeless and not to overconsume and to be meat-free and to give refuge to refugees and to volunteer in prisons and to protect our earth. And then I would say also looking to women for leadership and addressing racism and building community and a just economic order and fundamentally to end war and to be a peacemaker. These are just some of the things that come to me, come up for me in regards to, you know, first is really developing our capacity, reframing what compassion means, engaging our communities locally and globally, and then to make compassion viral.
So that's, well,
that's all you have to do.
And stop all war.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate this, and what I love about what you said, it, you know, one of the things that really stuck with me is disrupt our complacency, because there's no shortage of things that we can do, and you've just given us this beautiful list of all the ways that we can be compassionate in the world for the benefit of ourselves and all beings. And so I think we've got a pretty good to-do list here, Roshi Joan. Thank you so much.
Good. And practice grace.
Thank you for saying that. And I wanted to ask the question, if someone wanted to learn the grace process, is this something that they can find by going to your website, or can they take one of your courses? Could you educate us on that?
Yeah, well, we just finished our big annual clinician training, which is a really exceptional training primarily for doctors and nurses, where people get 54 CMEs and CNEs. Also, some social workers, psychologists, chaplains, and volunteers are in that training. We just finished that about a week ago, or, you know, we just finished it recently. and the grace training we also just finished recently. So we will be, UPAYA will be offering both trainings next year. And they are really extraordinary. It's www.upaya.org. And also on that website, you'll find various articles, and when you go onto my YouTube channel, you'll see a number of illustrated talks that I've given on the heuristic model of compassion and on grace. So it's being adopted and adapted in many parts of the world and translated into many languages now. It's very powerful and moving to see this particular method, which is so inclusive, moving out into the world in the way it is. And the center of that, the training process, happens here at UPAYA.
Wow. Well, just so much gratitude to you for using, you know, your time, your skills, your intellect, your heart to bring this to the world as you do and have done for so long. Just thank you so much for who you are in the world and what you contribute. It's a true gift. You are a true gift.
Well, thank you, and thank you for what you're doing to bring compassion more into the forefront of our society.
Well, it's my pleasure to be of service in this way. And I just want to make sure that people know the website address again is upaya.org, and that's U, P as in Paul, AYA.org. And it's also in Roshi Jones' bio on the website. When you look for the Global Compassion Summit, you'll see it with her bio. So, Roshi Joan, it's been an honor sharing this time with you. Again, thank you for the gift of your time and for all that you do to bring this emerging field of compassion to the forefront in very practical ways that can serve all of humanity. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. You have a beautiful day. Everybody have a beautiful day. Do whatever you can to benefit others. Thank you.
Excellent. And we'll leave with Disrupt Our Complacency, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. What a wonderful session with Roshi Joan Halifax. Please be sure to join us for the next session of the Global Compassion Summit. We're so pleased that you could be with us today.
Wonderful. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for the Summer of Peace, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Summer of Peace and the World Peace Library, visit summerofpeace.net. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.